New West, Hill Country. Act 1, A Will to Meaning. The bacon popped and sizzled. The cast iron pushed its heat through the pork belly. His calloused hand wrapped around the warm handle. He loved that smell. Hell, he thought. Everyone does. Alone in the small shack kitchen, he laughed. I bet even them plant people like the smell of bacon. He flipped the meat, making sure not to overcrisp either side, and then took the pan off the flame and put it on a quarter-inch steel plate which lay atop the rough cedar counter. The handle was too hot for modern hands. His weren't that way. Work had made them swollen in the palm, then sinewed around the knuckles. The skin was dried like cheap leather, cut and busted across. The bacon would finish cooking in the residual heat of the iron, and it would be ready by the time he found Caroline, his daughter. He knew where she'd be this time on a Sunday morning. She'd have finished her morning chores, and then, with her mom's permission, snuck off to the bowl, to the west, where a field of Indian paintbrush, Mexican hat, and tall blue stem swayed in the north winds brought by spring. At 8 years of age, this was a fine thing to do. In a couple of years, she would need to stay at her mother's side through the long work day, every day. She would toil as they all did just to survive in this new West, where there was no more electricity or cars, fewer laws, and more trouble. Everything had been forced backward in time. He pushed open the door of corrugated metal, hinged to the pole frame of the barn. The bright sun reflected off the caliche, and when he squinted, the lines around his eyes gathered in valleys. His heels kicked dust into the air, and the wind played with it, spun it behind him as he moved up the hill to where he could call down to Caroline. It was his wife's name also, but he said it differently to his daughter because she was younger and not yet hardened. He saw her walking down the bowl and through the side oats and blue stem toward the lowest field of wildflowers. The blue bonnets lowered toward him, and the red-dipped paintbrushes bowed this way then that, moving color across the landscape. At first, he didn't call her name because he wanted to just watch. He squatted to pick a paintbrush whose seed had blown up out of the bowl, and as he reached for the flower, he saw it tremble. Not yet, was the helpless thought that entered his mind as he instinctively placed his calloused palms on the ground. He felt the trembling of the earth itself, and still prone, as if he was praying, he whispered and then screamed, "Caroline!" and shot up straight and then forward, running down the face of the bowl.
"Caroline!"
Running into the north wind, which pushed the urgency of his voice back into his face and then stole it off behind him and toward the house. His wife heard her name, but his daughter couldn't. The girl walked lightly among the flowers, her hands floating at her sides, touching them all, and looking for the perfect ones to pick for the old bottle they proudly cleaned and used as a vase. As her fingers grazed the tips of the flowers, they sent clouds of pollen into the air, and those clouds trailed off behind her, like contrails once did in the sky, something she had never seen. She hummed an outdated tune to herself. The words evolved, and loved the way the flowers looked, how they felt against the palm of her hand as she pressed into them. He ran wildly into the strengthening headwind. If the wind hadn't immersed them, she would have heard him. If she wasn't in the daydreams of an 8-year-old, she would have felt the ground shaking beneath her. But she was, and she didn't. And then she did. She heard his voice and stopped, turning, and at once knew she was too far from the shelter. She didn't drop the flowers in her hand. She screamed and leaned her body into a run toward her father. She began to wail as she ran toward him, and he toward her. In the distance behind her, he saw a silhouette, a rising range of dust peeking the far side of the bowl. He heard the sound of tens of thousands of cloven hooves beating against the limestone. When they stampeded, The feral hogs were a tide of death and destruction. It always started small. A boss hog might gore another over a breeding sow, and then one of their saunders of 50 subservient hogs would cut through the others, escalating into a battle over territory and water. The violence and screaming would work neighboring saunders into a fury that lit into a fire across the plains west of the hill country. The blood-soaked squeals and hoarse, mad howls would echo from one saunder to another through the canyons to the south and across the rolling granite hills to the north. They were threatening and boasting and calling each other to blood and violence and feast. Each saunder raised the specter of the next until hundreds became thousands, pouring like rivers into a common tide. A specter of which the bison dreamt, a dust cloud rising mile wide and longer than birds could see. 100,000 hogs cut, ate, and shed everything in their path, pounding the hills to announce their coming. Caroline ran as fast as an 8-year-old, and he ran as fast as only a father could. They crashed into each other, and he threw her over his shoulder and turned, pushing hard into the shaking ground as the first hogs crested the hill at twice his speed. The first were the adolescents, whose age drove them harder and faster. Their bodies were lean and barely larger than Caroline. Their cutters were only 3 inches, but razor sharp. They could eviscerate deer or dog or man with a thrust of their body and turn of their head. Behind the adolescents were the boars. They were aged more than 8 years, monsters weighing 300 pounds. As they lowered their heads and pushed forward, the boars' long cutters ran into the ones beside them, stabbing the armor of musky and hardened fat around their necks. Each sting was encouragement to drive harder. In the center of the hogs were the alphas of each saunder, who exceeded the average hog in size, anger, and depredation. The adolescents would push anything they trampled towards the boars, who would tear off a mouthful and push the carcass toward their alpha, out of respect and pragmatic fear. The adolescents crested the hill, their eyes wild and scanning the bowl below them. They were ahead of the dust and would steer the stampede toward anything they thought it wanted, anything that moved. He pushed his legs and cried as the birds flew past him, and he held her on his shoulder with his one arm while the other swung wildly, flailing through the air and the evaporating time he needed to get her there, to the buried shipping container that functioned as a shelter. He knew Caroline, the mother, would already be there, and he pushed and flailed, and the live oaks around him shed their leaves. The adolescents saw them and steered the mass toward them, leaning into their pumping necks, gaining momentum as they came down the side of the bowl. A few buckled and fell underfoot, only to be rolled and trampled and then quickly replaced as their bodies were sent into the blender of hooves. They would be softened for the juveniles and pregnant sows that followed the herd and feasted on the scraps and the errant buzzard who dared to land on a piece of meat. Full enough of the trampled parts, a pregnant sow would lunge through the air and get the buzzard by the leg, pulling him down, devouring his acidic body whole. Caroline, the mother, was indeed in the shelter, and although the shipping container was almost entirely buried, it was shaking violently. She had lost her first husband and children and grieved, and then met the girl's father. She had her free times, but she stayed because it was good to have a family. And she didn't want to go back to the spiral in which she had lived in after she had lost her first one. They had lived through a handful of stampedes, and it seemed they were coming earlier each year. Her husband had buried the shipping container for just this reason. She was glad he did, and as he ran, he wished he had done so closer to the bowl, or that he hadn't let the girl wander so far, or that he was younger with legs that would carry them faster. But he hadn't, and he had, and he wasn't. He could hear the pounding, and then the squeals, and the heaving, faster, harder, up the closed side of the bowl. He imagined the boar's wretched breath on his neck as he came up on the buried top of the container. He knew that if he ran and leapt the 9 feet, he would crumble and break her neck, and everything he had done in his life would mean nothing. He wanted to turn and scream and run into the boars with his fists raised and grab them by their mouths and drive them into the ground. That second-to-last fantasy that his mind gave him disappeared as his eyes connected with those of Caroline, the mother, and he dropped to his knees at the container's edge and lowered the girl to her, as he had done when she was a baby. Time stopped, and he looked into the mother's eyes and then the daughter's, and she reached for him as the wild river overtook him, pouring through his body and over the edge of the container. The juvenile hogs, and many parts of him, launching into the air. Caroline, the mother, had already slammed the door shut, and the image of the girl reaching out to him had been the last fantasy his mind gave him. Caroline, the daughter, huddled in the corner of the buried and shaken container. She screamed like a newborn as wave after wave of hogs poured over the shelter, their hooves pounding on the steel drum, over and onto each other, on and on. She screamed for an eternity. Caroline the widow wore her best white cotton dress. She sat across from the sheriff at his desk, an assembly of wood that served, as all desks do, as an intermediary, an artifice of authority shoved between people.
This didn't need to happen. You said the government were going to start the bounty again and the hogs would be cut down.
They said...
You said when you ran for that badge and horse...
Caroline...
Don't you dare!
The contempt she showed him rooted in familiarity. She let it go as quickly as it had overcome her, because she wasn't there to talk about that. She looked over the desk to see if its surface was more worn on one side, whether one of the drawers was used more often. Her mind raced. She asked herself, "Here, would you put it?" He was relieved that her eyes weren't on him and retreated to her accusation about hogs. "I've written letters to the officials here in the West and further," and then continued, wishing what he was about to say were true. "We might hear from the Appalachian Empire in a month. I'm hopeful. Maybe even the United South will help."
"No, no, no, you're not."
She didn't look up, because now she didn't want to look eye to eye. She didn't want to risk connection. She wanted to get it done. She was done staring at the desk, because she had an idea which drawer it was in, and she needed him to walk away, maybe to the shelves, to the doorway or the window, just far enough. "You don't know," the sheriff started to explain before Caroline cut him off.
"I do know."
She raised her eyes so that her glare cut through him.
"I know you tell people what you want them to believe. That you believe a whole bunch of things that nobody else gives a damn to think about."
He knew she was right about him. Her anger and pain were justified, and she was asking him to change something he couldn't. To get out from under her glare, the sheriff stood and walked to the window with his chair creaking. The pane of the window had a long crack together with yellowed and dried packing tape. Through it, he surveyed the rolling hills and endless sky, and he knew that she didn't see the same way. His back turned to her. He tried to see it the way she did. She saw a prison, a landscape from which she could not escape, mined with memories of the past and a future that mirrored the same. As he thought of what to say, she leaned over the desk and hooked her finger around the knob of the drawer to the left. She would wait until he spoke to pull on it. "I can't imagine your pain." And as the words came out, she pulled softly on the drawer, sliding it away from her hand and exposing its contents. "But I can promise you." She reached in the drawer and wrapped her fingers around the walnut handle. "That it's not a prison out there. It's a cruel world, and it takes everything from us piece by piece. But during our small bit of time, we have volition." He didn't turn, because he knew his words were useless. He didn't hear her move because the cotton dress she wore made no noise. It was so quiet that she used to say she could hunt whitetail in that dress. Her fingers wrapped around the smooth and always cool walnut handle. She lifted the heavy end first and pulled it silently out of the drawer. "I know he is looking down on you," he started again. "And I know your girl needs her mama. Even though it seems impossibly hard, they know you can do it. They know that you've been through worse. And they know you're going to make good from this.
John.
Without turning, he could tell from the direction of her voice that she had moved. And he was surprised he hadn't noticed before now. She repeated his name with a sadness to it.
John.
And he realized she was closer to his desk than he was. He hoped he wouldn't, but when he turned, he saw her standing there holding his grandfather's Colt revolver. Her elbow was high and bent, her hand wrapped tightly around the handle with her calloused finger on the trigger. She kept the long barrel of the Colt trained well enough on the side of her own head.
I can't do it anymore, John.
Yes, we can.
It's your empire of dirt, John.
You don't have to do this.
And your fucking volition.
Please.
Whatever the fuck that is.
A tear came from the corner of her eye, and then another and another until they were streaming down her worn and beautiful face, pooling on the dusty floor. The tip of the Colt oscillated because it was heavy, but her hand shook little because she was not scared. We can do it, he repeated, knowing he was lying. She tightened her index finger and took in the difference between the coolness of the smooth walnut handle and the texture of the trigger. She squeezed her slowly, not knowing where she would find the end.
I can't.
And then found it. The Colt's 45 round discharged in the chamber, escaped the barrel, entered her skull, and tore through her memories and fear of what would come, and exited as quickly as it had come, ending its short flight lodged in the ceiling. Her knees, then her elbows, then the Colt. Then her head hit the floor. The quiet, white cotton dress would not be given to Caroline, the daughter.